endeavoring to maintain the open and receptive mind of Zazen. I want to begin by just thanking you all, individually and together, for coming out on this cold January 9th to support this endeavor that really none of us can do alone. And it is a great gift to the Sangha at Waldo here, and the Sangha of Boundless Way, and of all beings, that each of you come out and really encounter yourself as we encounter ourselves together. And I also want to express thanks to James for courageously diving in and taking on the job of chant leader with pretty much no preparation other than a go get 'em tiger from me. And Kate, who is, I think, doing, by some counts, I think maybe 5 Zendo jobs over there in the corner. And Harriet as well, who supports the Sangha by teaching Raksuso in ancient and venerable tradition. there's a saying in Buddhism. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. What is this suffering that's optional? And what about when it isn't optional? What about when there is no avoiding it? So I want to begin with just a little story about that very phrase. I edited a book of excerpts called Daily Wisdom, and I included that one in it, and I cited it as by Bhante Henipola Gunaratna, author of Mindfulness in Plain English. Leaving aside for a moment that book was crafted in the words of someone else, but so I cited the author of Mindfulness in Plain English. I then, a little while later, saw that it had been attributed to Shakyamuni Buddha 2,500 years ago. And then shortly after that, I saw that it had also been attributed to Oscar Wilde. My creeping suspicion is that it's in fact none of them. Although, the last time I believed that to be true, there's another saying, things are not as they seem, nor are they otherwise. And I would have bet good money that was like Groucho Marx or W.C. But it turns out that one actually is the Buddha. That is a quote from the Avatamsaka Sutra. I looked it up. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. When I look back, kind of on my life, and look at the little kind of moments and kind of turnings and kind of goings on in my mind that led me to a Zen monastery, that led me to Zen, that led me to here, there are a few things that kind of stand out as kind of crystallizing moments. Some of you have heard me tell the story about when I was looking at these ducks, and they were just being ducks. And it was so clear to me, it was so easy for those ducks to be ducks, and so hard for me to be me. That was one of the things that proximally pushed me into a Zen monastery in college. But related to this saying, when I was a kid, I have this vivid memory of sitting at the dinner table with my father, and he was pouring Coke into his glass from a big 2-liter bottle of Coke. And he poured it in, and it just fizzed up, and then it just went all over the table. And he got so angry, and he was swearing and cursing. And I was sitting there at the other end of the table and thinking, how's that working for you? You know, on the one hand, you could just clean it up, or you could just get really upset about it. I didn't say that, probably wisely, but it was clear to me that he was bringing something extra, an extra amount of suffering to the table, as it were. And even earlier than that, I used to notice, especially around when I stubbed my toe, and we had, growing up, we had this kind of chair, this leather chair that kind of rocked back and forth, and it had an ottoman, and the base of the ottoman where it touched the floor had four metal things and a cross like this, and it was pretty heavy, and it was like optimal for just really injuring your toe on, and I would do that a lot. And I noticed that if I could get a grip on my mind and really pay attention, there was an opportunity, and this was before I even read any Zen or heard of Zen or anything, but I noticed that by far the greater part of my suffering in that moment was not the experience that I was having kind of in my foot. It was the experience that I was having in my mind. It was the anger that came as a result of my having stubbed my toe. It was anger at the chair, anger at myself, anger, just it kind of nameless anger at the pain, and also a kind of fear that would come up of oh my God, I've really done grave, grievous injury to myself here, and I'm probably going to walk with a limp for the rest of my life. And I noticed that was the part that was really hard, and that if I were really paying attention, I could just be with the physical experience and kind of leave it at that. And then I got to practice this so often because I stubbed my toe on that ottoman so much, I knew I had learned that it is always going to be the case that eventually this pain will pass. Because this is the 80th time I've done it. I was fine a minute ago. So clearly this pain that doesn't seem like it's ever going to fade will pass. And that enabled me to kind of just stay there with that experience in my foot. So those are some places where I have seen the optional nature of suffering. I'm particularly sensitive to sounds, and I don't know whether it's a autistic thing, almost. I was reading about autism, and in some ways it kind of sounds a little bit like me. I don't think that's what it is. Or it could be a brain injury thing. I had a severe concussion when I was in college and damaged the part of my brain that kind of filters out stimuli. But as a result, sounds really can get on my nerves enormously. Strangely, not when I'm practicing zazen. When I'm practicing zazen, it's very clear to me that I can just let the sounds kind of fall in. Master Dogen says, when the 10,000 things advance and confirm the self, that's realization. When the self goes out after the 10,000 things, that's delusion. And I can see that expressed in the sounds coming towards me, and I can just receive them, and I can see the way my mind moves in response to that. Like, don't those people sing an opera downstairs, don't they know that I'm really trying to do some Zen here? And I can see that going on in my mind, and it's relatively easy for me to recognize that storyline, that thought process, as something that has captured my attention, and then bring my attention back to the overflowingly full, ample presence of this moment, to this moment just as it is, to my butt on the cushion, to the neutral sounds arising, to the feeling of my abdomen going in and out. elsewhere than Zazen, that's not so clear to me. And as some of you, as some of you may know, I recently moved. My partner and I, we bought a condo, and there is much noise that kind of comes in off the street, and that has been an opportunity for me to encounter the mind of suffering and really get to know it. When I was in college, my one of my friends, who also knew nothing whatsoever about Zen, just observed of himself. He liked to sleep till around 2 in the afternoon, and he observed that, you know, those birds, it isn't the birds that keep me awake. It's my mind going, God damn those birds! And, you know, it's particularly funny. One of the guiding teachers of Boundless Way, Zen, Melissa, tends to always point out the, as part, she seems to be particularly attentive to birds, and she hears them really just singing the notes of thusness, of just the sound of the single hand expressing itself right here. Just a reminder of calling us into this moment. Me, I tend to hear the damn birds. in my new house, there's a really beautiful blue spruce tree, which seems to be the home here in the middle of January for what I think is roughly around 10,000 little chirpy birds. I don't really see them, but there's clearly a lot of them, and they're clearly all right in that tree. It's kind of strange. And this is a Somerville kind of three family situation with apartments with other condos to the side and below. And when we moved in, the one below us was vacant, hadn't been sold or rented yet. And then after a couple of weeks, it was no longer vacant. And I noticed going up the stairs that the person who had taken that apartment, and he had, was apparently renting it, was perhaps a young college kid. And then the next couple of days, there was just, it seemed like a bunch of people down there, and they were carrying on, and a lot of kind of wild, you know, a lot of laughing and staying up and kind of, and I was telling myself a whole lot of stories about this, of, oh my God, these people have no indoor voices, they're so insensitive, they're just, it's just, it's going to be like this forever, obviously, it's going to go for like the full 30 years of my mortgage, it's going to be exactly like this. And, you know, this guy is, I mean, and the problem is, the real problem, I mean, it's not the noise, it's the fact that he's just such a jerk. He's obviously a jerk, you know, because, and that was just like so difficult and unpleasant in my head. And then a couple of days of that went on, and I really put a lot of energy into my story about this completely insensitive guy. And, you know, I don't even think that he could afford this apartment. I think it's probably just the largesse of his father who bought it for him. And, you know, if he had to pay for it himself, then, you know, that would be a higher class of people. But this is... and so then after a couple of days, there's a knock on our door, and it's the guy from downstairs, and he was saying, and he said to my wife and I, he said, so I just wanted to let you know that for these last few days I had some friends visiting from New York, and I realized that you know, some noise may have been coming up, and I just wanted you to know that it's really, that's extremely uncommon, and I, there's, that almost never happens, and I really just want you to feel completely free to let me know if any noise is ever bothering you, and you know, in fact, I'm thinking about maybe getting some additional soundproofing on the ceiling, because actually I'm a music producer, and so you know, I actually have a lot of experience, you know, and so all of my my story about all of this is just right out the window, and that was really a great teaching for me, and it was a great reminder about the way I can make my pain so much worse, or even my suffering, which is, you know, I mean, I do have reactions to noise, including the traffic, and you know, but nothing is ever so bad that it can't be made worse by the way we use our mind in relation to it. The good news there is that then we can also work with the way we use our mind. One of the great ancient Zen teachers of China, Master Zhao Zhou, Zhoushu, who gave us such poems as Mu and the oak tree in the garden and various other things, he taught until he was very old, I think the legends say over 100, and he said that he would, if he encountered an old man, he would teach him, and if he had something to say, and if he encountered even a young girl, which was very low on the great chain of Chinese being compared to an old man, and that person, if that person had something to teach him, he would sit at their feet, and This is a reminder, and we also hear this in Tori Zenji's Bodhisattva's vow, that how each flash of thought is a Buddha appearing to us, each person causing us suffering, each person who we have indifferent reaction to, each person, each situation we grasp after, that's the Buddha appearing to us. There's an opportunity there. And yet, still we suffer. And sometimes this avoidable suffering isn't avoidable. And I was actually having such a hard time. I work at home on Tuesdays. And I had gotten myself into such a state about the traffic noise that I had concluded that clearly just all evidence that, you know, we can just clearly see that I just suck too much to be able to sit up here and open my mouth and presume to talk about Zen tonight, because I'm just so miserable, I'm so wrapped up, and I was actually, gonna skip the talk tonight. Another great service. So Bart is actually here for the first time tonight, and he read a talk that I gave, and it's transcribed online. It's about the Zen practice of being defeated, and I asked him what got him here, and he mentioned that among other things, and you know, that reminded me of my own practice of being defeated, and of being Barry Magid, a Zen teacher in the Ordinary Mind School, talks about our secret practice. This is the practice that we're really doing, as opposed to the practice that we may say we're doing, such as counting our breath or noticing when our mind gets captivated by a thought and bringing it back to this moment. That's what we would probably say we're doing. But our secret practice is really trying to feel more compassionate, really trying to feel special, trying to have an enlightenment experience, trying to experience calm or relaxation. All of these things are some form or another. Or trying to fix ourselves. Or trying to fix someone else. All of these things are forms that our secret practice can be. This thing that we're, this hidden agenda that we have, that we subvert our actual practice of encountering this moment, of our usness, of our lives, that we subvert that into. All of those things happen. Sometimes we feel calm. Sometimes you feel compassionate. You sit Zen long enough. At some point or another, your mind may settle down. You may have some insight. All of those things are side effects. And aiming at those becomes a secret practice. And I realized that my secret practice was trying to be a good Zen teacher. Trying to be a guy who has something to say, trying to be a guy who is like special enough to be able to sit at the front of the room and talk about Zen. But that was not what was available to me. That was not what my life was. My practice was being defeated by what was for me actually some unavoidable suffering. And it's so easy for us to lose track of this very, very subtle, the real kernel of this practice, which is very, very subtle, very, very small. It's really just being intimately present to whatever moment it is that we're encountering. Being present to all of the tumult of our mind, all of the pain, the anxiety, the fear, our craziness, our sense of brokenness, our sense of utter failure at being a human being. Being present for that is a practice that's always available to us. And in my case, it's actually available to me quite a lot. But whereas these other practices, these other secret practices, trying to feel calm, trying to feel enlightened, trying to be a good Zen student, a good Zen teacher, all of those things, those are hit or miss. Sometimes we can get that, sometimes not. But the real skill that we're practicing, literally practicing, I mean, each time we pick up our place on the cushion, and each time we notice that our mind has gotten captivated over there, and we come to this moment just as it is, we are training ourselves to be able to be present to ourselves, to our craziness, not to the one that we wish we were, not to the one we think we could be, or we were yesterday, or we were on retreat, but to the one that is here now. And there's such solace, such that there's refuge in the one who's here now is that's the diamond refuge. That's the refuge that can't be destroyed or taken away or lost. Even when it is lost. So, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. And sometimes it's not. Thank you, John. So I want to leave space here for anyone to offer comments or questions or observations of your own experience, complaints. And this is this practice of sharing, of putting yourself forward, is also a practice, and it is also a practice of courage. So I encourage you to pick that up, or if not, that's fine too. Excellent.
I found that when I'm trying to fly, those damn birds are going out there. But if I'm not trying to do anything, then I just keep doing the truth. But there are nothing around there. Because I have those same birds going out past my house.
They commute.
We have bushes.
Well, that's interesting. For me, my base state is damn birds. Your base state, it sounds like, is being able to appreciate the chirping. Yeah. But there is that difference, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Usually
they're damn birds. Minds, huh?
Place of infinite time, meaning that it's, nothing's going to change for infinity. And of course, you know, rationally, I think that that's not the case, but in the middle of the suffering, there's this state of infinite that it's never going to end. So when I'm able to practice with that, it just kind of finds us to see what is that life, what is that infinite time like, because it's a very scary time, because you want the suffering to be over soon, and you want to do things to make it go even sooner. But just to sort of experience this sort of timeless truth that seems to go on and on forever.
There's a practice we can do even in that infinite moment of suffering.
There's a lot of fear involved in that because you can't see an end even though you know the doctor says it's going to be filled. Yeah, it'll be over in an hour or so. You probably won't be crippled. But,
although you never know, because maybe this time you will be crippled.
when I was sitting here, my ankle was hurting, and I made sure that I wasn't feeling it coming to my ankle. It was still hurting. And of course, the timer, I'm pretty sure it has stopped.
And Kate's fallen asleep like she usually does, yeah.
She set it to 50 for something.
And what do you do in that infinite moment?
I try not to hold my breath, but I don't know. I'm just trying to see, just trying to experience.
Yeah. And sometimes we can't see an end, you know, and sometimes it's, you know, something that we can appreciate has a humorous quality, like, you know, like some of the examples that you gave, although it's not humorous to experience it. Although sometimes there's also a way to practice with depression in the same way. And part of depression is kind of a certainty that this darkness that you're feeling now is going to last forever, and you can't remember anything else. And you can't see that light at the end of the tunnel. And there's practice available even there. It isn't contingent on being able to see the light at the end of the tunnel. It isn't contingent on anything. And cosmologically, you know, this is represented by, there's a Buddha who teaches in hell, in the hell realms, even in the hells of great suffering you can still encounter. Thank you for that. And thank you also for sharing all of those internal processes, because I think that, you know, when everybody laughs, it's because we've all had those thoughts too, and it's a really great service to the Sangha to give voice to that, in the same way that we're all certain that we're definitely the worst Zen student in the room. Hit me. Yeah? That, for me, sometimes a practice is to look for the fear that's at the bottom, or to ask myself, what is it that often a lot of my suffering, a lot of my pain, a lot of my anger, especially, there's fear that's driving. Yeah. Right. or carpeting. there's a Buddhist parable about, you know, a princess who had very sensitive feet, and so she had the streets paved with leather, and she had the mountains covered in leather, and she had all the other things covered in leather. And finally she met a wise man who said, you know, you could wear shoes. Thank you.